Well, she was the young woman from Scranton with no college degree and indeed who shunned credentials, moved to New York in 1934 and fell in love with its old neighborhoods. Became a savvy community activist and at the same time wrote a book, The Death and Life of Great American Cities, that revolutionized planning and changed the way we think about cities. He was the power broker, dapper and swaggering, on the swim team at Yale, with a PhD from Oxford, who single-handedly built so much of the New York we know today, its bridges and byways, parks and swimming pools, Jones Beach, the UN building, Shea Stadium, and of course the housing towers that rose up in the era of urban renewal. Jane Jacobs and Robert Moses, what makes their collision so compelling and why we're gathered here tonight is not only the drama of their seemingly irreconcilable differences at the time, roughly a half century ago, but the urgent relevance of their legacies today. Jane Jacobs left us the owner's manual for the livable city, and her embrace of the human-scale urban neighborhoods endures in principles uniformly embraced by the planning and design professions to this day. But we're also faced with the myriad challenges for the city of the 21st century. The city, after all, being, I believe, the greenest form of human settlement that we can aspire to as we grapple with energy independence and climate change. Our cities seemingly need a vision for critical infrastructure, not the highways in the historical context that we'll be talking about tonight, but truly urban infrastructure such as light rail, subways, streetcars, and indeed inner city rail. Our cities and their place in the new green economy and the premium on economic competitiveness is also something that Robert Moses surely could relate to. Well, what are the lessons from the era of the automobile, and how can we best frame the context for the urban future, what we might think of as the reinvented city? We'll hear from our distinguished panelists and engage in a conversation here tonight. And now please allow me to make brief introductions. Roberta Brandes-Gratz is a journalist, author, and urban critic. Her work spans broad urban development issues based on organic incremental concepts like urban husbandry. Her published works include Cities Back from the Edge, New Life for Downtown, and The Living City, Thinking Small in a Big Way. She is the author of the just-published book, The Battle for Gotham, New York in the Shadow of Robert Moses and Jane Jacobs. And she was a friend of Jane Jacobs, so the book includes never-before-seen interviews with Jane. In 2003, she was appointed by Mayor Michael Bloomberg to the New York City Landmarks Preservation Commission. She's received awards from the American Institute of Architects, the American Planning Association, the Municipal Arts Society, the New York Press Club, and the City Club of New York. And she, of course, has written for The Wall Street Journal, New York Times Magazine, The Nation, City Limits, The Daily News, and The New York Post. And she was instrumental in the founding of the Center for the Living City. Owen Goodfriend is an associate professor of urban affairs and planning at Hunter College. Previously, he was on the faculty at Columbia University, where he taught urban history, urban planning, and international affairs, and served for many years as the director of the joint Barnard-Columbia Urban Studies Program. He has published 20th Century Sprawl, Highways and the Reshaping of the American Landscape by Oxford University Press, and was one of the authors of Robert Moses and the Modern City, The Transformation of New York, which was published in conjunction with the Moses exhibits that we heard about earlier. He's an associate editor of the forthcoming second edition of the Encyclopedia of New York City, is on the editorial board of the Journal of Urban History. He's currently working on Cities Take Flight, Airports, Aviation, and Modern American Urbanism, a book about the impact of airports and air travel on American cities. Well, both Roberta and Owen will make their remarks for 12 minutes, each one after the other. And at that point, I will ask a question or two of both of them before turning it to all of you and opening the conversation up to the audience. So we will begin with Owen.
Thank you, Anthony, for that introduction. There has been, over the last few years, a great deal of attention focused on Robert Moses and Jim Jacobs. For many decades, there were essentially one book apiece on these two larger than life figures. And fortunately, in the last few years, people really started to think about what should we learn from their impact on the city and their suggestions and their approach. And in the process, it's become standard, I think, to really think of them in opposition to each other. And as was mentioned in the introductory remarks, they did clash. And there was a very well-known clash between the two of them about 50 years ago over a question of should we build a Lower Manhattan Crosstown Expressway and a Fifth Avenue Expressway, which would have, if they had been built, produced a dramatically different Manhattan than we now have here and presumably have some affection for. But I think that this focus on their clash does both of them something of a disservice. I think that Robert Moses was much more than the Lower Manhattan Expressway, and Jane Jacobs was much more than not the Lower Manhattan Expressway. And we can fall into a trap thinking that 50 years later, what we need to do is choose sides in a battle that is half a century past. So I want to focus here on two things. First of all, to suggest that there are lessons that we should be learning from both of them as we think about how to shape the city for the 21st century. And also to put, I think, both of them into the context of a national scale. It's too easy for us to think of only New York and only the battles that they fought with each other. But the lessons we can learn from both of them apply to understanding the American landscape more generally, American cities, and how they have been dysfunctional and could be more functional going forward. So that's the tenor of what I want to focus on here. I'll back up for a minute and say a couple of things about each one of them, go through a couple of quick points of ways in which their divergent opinions are both meritorious and need to be taken into account. And I'm going to try not to dwell on the things that I think were necessarily terribly wrong about each of them, and then go into that piece of context. So first of all, Robert Moses. Timing is very important for Robert Moses. I'm originally trained as a historian, and I'm now a teacher of minors, so I'm used to the idea that we need to understand when things happened in order to figure out what they mean and how we can learn from it. Robert Moses came to power in the 1920s, and it was a serendipitous moment for him. He started to figure out how the workings of government worked and how to get things done at the very moment the government got bigger than it had ever been before. And he took his very shrewd studies of bureaucracies and political power that he learned as an undergraduate at Yale and a graduate student in Oxford, and learned how to harness the available funds coming through the New Deal from Washington, and started doing stuff. And the first time in a long time, the government had been an active doer. From the 1920s then until through the 1950s and the early 1960s, he was gathering resources and spending them. Let me just, as an aside, say, I want to acknowledge, because this was apparent in all my research on New York and on Robert Moses, and in other settings too, when he consulted in other cities, he became an unchecked power that was counterproductive in many ways. He was mean-spirited, he was megalomaniacal. All these things that Robert Caro describes so well in his book, The Power Broker, which, as an aside, I will say, every time over the last 30 years when I've said to people that I'm interested in New York City and how it works in cities and how things get built or which things don't get built, and how these things get played, people always say, oh, you must have read The Power Broker. It has been a shaping tone on the topic. Interestingly enough, I had a number of recent conversations with people telling them I was going to be on a panel about Robert Moses and Jane Jacobs, and only some of them knew who Jane Jacobs was, but they all knew who Robert Moses was. And that I think will decreasingly be the case because of the fine scholarship that's come out recently on Jim Jacobs. But the point is that I think people have a skewed view of the entire topic because it was defined by a book, a single book that presented a skewed view of Robert Moses. So, yes, he was megalomaniacal and out of control and mean-spirited, but would New York City have thrived without his efforts? I will emphatically say, I don't think New York City would be a thriving metropolis of the 21st century were it not for most of what Robert Moses did. The vast majority of his accomplishments were beneficial, and fortunately, I would say, he was stopped before he could do some of the most destructive things that he wanted to do, aside from the Lower Manhattan Expressway. There was a Midtown, Cross Midtown Expressway that he wanted to build. He wanted to build a bridge connecting Oyster Bay to Rye, and potentially another one from Orient Point at the end of Long Island to Rhode Island. He continued to think bigger and bigger at a time when, in my opinion, he accomplished all that we needed of. The context of Jane Jacobs, and I'm sure that Roberta is going to speak some more about her, so I won't go into very much detail on the subject. But the context of Jane Jacobs, the timing again is important, because many of the things that were built and paid for with New Deal money and with post-World War II housing initiatives that were designed to address a World War II housing shortage produced some problematic results. The scale on which things were being done, the huge urban renewal projects, the way in which we approach public housing, the destruction of urban expressway building that was experienced in cities all across the country, whether they had a Robert Moses or not. All those things were apparent and becoming apparent by the late 1950s and 1960s. And Jane Jacobs was one of the earliest, most forceful, most insightful, and effective voices saying, whoa, slow down here. This isn't necessarily good for our cities. And it's time to rethink the way people are approaching planning. So they did have this moment of conflict over the Lower Manhattan Expressway. But I would argue that this was at the end of Robert Moses' three decades of effectiveness and was the rise of Jane Jacobs. And they both were products of different eras. And she was a sign of things to come, and he was a sign of an approach from an earlier period. And both of those need to be taken into account in their own historical context. Okay, things that we can learn from both of them. So first of all, right off the top, I'll have to say that if somebody says to me, even though everybody says, oh, have you read the whole book? But if somebody says, what one book should I read to understand how urban planning can affect the way people live their lives and improve urban function, I would suggest that they start with The Death and Life of Great American Cities by Jane Jacobs. It remains to this day something that is a must read for people that want to understand how cities work and how they can work better. Let me run through a couple of things we can learn from each of them. I limited my time, and I didn't watch my watch here, so I'm going to speak quickly about each of these things, and I'm happy to elaborate on them later if you choose. Well, I already mentioned Robert Moses was particularly good at using available programs to do that which had been already planned but seemed undoable. This is something that we need to pay attention to. How did he do this? We are filled with ideas on how we can fix cities in the 21st century. And we are not filled with evidence that this is happening on a large scale and the government is moving to do all these things. There are definitely bright spots to point to. But somebody who figured out how to look at existing regulations, existing rules, existing funding streams, and to twist them to whatever purpose it is he was trying to accomplish. This was a bureaucratic, technocratic skill that I fear we could use somewhat today because it seems like nothing can get done. At the same time, the flip side of that, from Jane Jacobs' perspective, as I've mentioned earlier, sometimes we must stop and reconsider the current approach. Instead of trying to work within it and make the most of it and harness it, we need to say, change gears altogether, this is wrong. We need to change the rules, change the parameters, change the objectives in order to be effective. The biggest difference between the two, which has already been mentioned, but I want to point out, is the question of scale. I constantly find myself, when I'm talking to urban planning students and urban design students, pointing out that they must be able to think about being effective at all scales. And this is where I think both Jane Jacobs and Robert Moses had strengths and weaknesses. Robert Moses was thinking not just citywide, beyond the city, region-wide, about how you build transportation and circulation and park systems that work for a city as a whole. I would argue that none of these, especially transportation systems, can be done on a local basis. So on the region-wide scale, and Robert Moses thought we need to do that. However, on the local scale, the human scale, the scale of the block and the neighborhood that Jane Jacobs advocated so well, we need to think about how each proposed initiative, even if it is to benefit the city as a whole or the region as a whole, how it will affect each neighborhood, each block, each community that it goes through. There's a flip side to this, of course. Robert Moses used that saying often. I don't think he coined it, but it's certainly one that we've heard repeated many times. If you want to make an omelet, you have to break some eggs. It is important for us to think about the effect of large projects on neighborhoods, block by block, and the way people's lives on the human scale will be affected. However, that does not mean that everything must be from the bottom, planned from the bottom up, and that every community gets to plan what will happen for the city as a whole. In some ways, I think that's why so little can get done. There are going to be times when things that are necessary for a city, especially a city metropolitan area, 22 million people, to survive, thrive, and prosper, that there are going to be people who don't get what they want. And those are often going to be people whose lives are affected negatively by that proposed project. Finding the balance between those two things, scale, is an essential lesson. I think neither of these people that we're talking to here operated on multiple scales in an adequate way. The question of government power. Robert Moses believed that government power could be wielded to help the city to adapt infrastructure to new times, new needs, and a changing world. And in a lot of ways, Jane Jacobs, as she saw the way this government power was used and destroyed neighborhoods and didn't produce many of the benefits that had been promised, Jane Jacobs was an advocate for allowing, to a great extent, markets to do their work. It's an interesting quandary. Jane Jacobs often refused, I think quite rightly, to be pigeonholed politically. She was heralded as a 1960s community protest heroine, quite rightly, because some of the things that she did, she led community-based protests. At the same time that she was, and Roberta knows more about this and might say more about it when the time comes, she had a libertarian, less government would be better. Government should not intervene, but we need the, on this block scale, we need organic markets with separate landlords. We shouldn't have government being a single landlord and producing things on a 4 or 5, 6 square block, a super block scale. We need to allow economic variation. And I think both of those are lessons that we need to learn from. The biggest lesson, though, that I took from her arguments about scale is the lesson of mixed use. Mixed use and diversity of function and diversity of people are what makes urban space work well. And when you look at urban space that does not work well for one way or one reason or another, it is often because it is single use. And this was the planning approach from really 1910, before Robert Moses. He didn't write these things. In fact, actually, one point I'd like to make is Robert Moses envisioned almost nothing. He built upon other people's visions. He was visionary to the extent that he saw ways to execute other people's plans. Most of what he built had been sketched by others before he rose to power. The idea of block upon block of housing with no retail or commercial activity was the planning standard approach before Robert Moses even thought about doing anything to do with urban planning. And Jay Jacobs came along and said, that's one of the cities. And that mixed-use idea, mixed-use, mixed-income, she was right on with that, and he was not, and that's one of those places I'm not going to say we should learn something from both of them. She had it right on. My time is just about up here, so I'll very quickly talk about cars in the city, the exhibit that's upstairs, Robert Moses building highways, building bridges, building no mass transit. The bottom line is this. Other American cities that have no Robert Moses are more car dependent than New York. We cannot blame traffic in New York necessarily on Robert Moses. We can't blame the evisceration of American cities, the abandonment of urban cores, the flight to the suburbs of residential, commercial, industrial capital in every city across the country. We can't blame that on Robert Moses. He did manage to adapt a pre-automotive city to the automobile era. And we end up with the most balanced transportation system in the United States here in New York. And it's hard for me to imagine what New York would have looked like if we didn't have the bridges and expressways and parkways that Robert Moses built. Could they have been built with mass transit integrated into them? Yes, they could have if the federal government hadn't prohibited it. And this is where I just want to say something about context. The national policy context is that starting in the 1910s and 20s, we committed to adapting the American transportation infrastructure to accommodate the other. The federal government subsidized the construction of highways all across the nation. The movement of Americans into their cars and away from mass transit with government subsidy, the movement of Americans where they live, where they work, where they shop, where they play, to the suburbs, into the urban periphery, and away from the city, that left cities in such dire straits in the 70s. This was not the doing of Robert Moses. The fact that a few years after he was removed from power in New York City was at its low point cannot be blamed on Robert Moses when many, many, many other cities were equally devastated and were not equipped with the infrastructure they needed to bounce back to New York.
Right, well, thank you very much for asking that. Thank you very much for having this one. And now at this point, for the friendliest thanks, over to you.
Well, this should be an interesting conversation. There are many points on which we clearly disagree. First, let me say that my book does focus on the clash between them, and it goes way beyond.
Yeah, Lord.
He can flip the phone.
I'm going to get it closer.
Now you can hear me.
This one's working.
So I will repeat that I think this will be an interesting conversation because there are many issues on which we disagree. But let me just say as background that my new book does focus on the clash of visions between Robert Moses and Jane Jacobs way beyond the Lower Manhattan Expressway, the village fights, even the local, it takes us way beyond New York cities in general because these two forces had a lot to do with shaping the American and some foreign cities. So it's very important to understand really what they stood for and what they didn't stand for. But even though it's a little hard to see you all, I just need to have a show of hands. How many in this audience have read The Power Broker? Good. It's a start. Everybody should read The Power Broker. Death and Life? Yes. But first you need to know how things happen before you can understand how they should have happened. The first half of the 20th century was the era of the streetcar, long-distance rail, and the emerging leisure time vehicle called the automobile. The second half was the era of the automobile dominance and the dissolution of the existing mass transit systems that needed new investment after World War II, but got destroyed or further undermined instead. The 21st century needs to be devoted to returning our city and the country to a balanced transportation system. This not only means the continued rebuilding of our subway system in this city, ongoing since the defeat of Westway and trade-in of highway funding in the mid-1980s, but the continued provision for more biking capacity and improved light and heavy rail. Before we can move forward, however, we have to know how we got to the mess we're in. And we need to dispel some myths, especially about Robert Moses. True, Moses didn't invent the vision of the car-based city, but he appropriated the vision and ruthlessly got it done. True, Moses was not the first and only highway promoter, but his sin was to undermine mass transit that he did not believe in. Our city's transit system was larger and functioned better when Moses came to power in the 30s than when he fell from power in the late 60s and early 70s. The more highways that got built and the more provisions made to accommodate cars in the city, the more ridership fell on both the LIRR and the subways. The city, I would argue, was even less equipped for modern times when he left than would have evolved organically without him. For all the talk about growing the modern city, New York lost population and lost transit capacity during Moses' reign. By my calculations, between all this urban renewal and highway projects, close to a million, at least a million people and businesses were displaced, which at the time of a population of 8 million in the city is about 20% of the city's population of businesses. The immigration influx, neighborhood-based regeneration efforts, the back to the city movement, and the economic boom of the 90s are what repopulated the city. The defeat of Westway helped shift the transportation debate from roads to rail, and the trade-in of Westway funds for transit jump-started the renewal of our local and regional transit system, which today still is a long way to go. I detail a lot of this in my book. But even more unfortunate, the even more unfortunate Moses myth is that Moses was a man of his times. I argue he helped shape these times, and that there was no evidence of mass transit advocacy to offer an alternative vision to his automobile-only policies. In June 1955, urban critic Lewis Mumford wrote in the New Yorker magazine, "Before we cut any more chunks out of our parks to make room for more automobiles, or let another highway Cloverleaf unfold, we should look at the transformation that has taken place during the last 30 years in Manhattan." This, of course, did not happen. Even before Moses and the highway lobby starved the subways of financial support, bus and railroad systems of funding, as Robert Carroll points out so well in The Power Broker, the realization emerged that more roads breed more traffic, that building more roads does not solve traffic congestion, and that the only answer was coordinating mass transit improvements for highways. Moses adamantly opposed this idea in every way possible and controlled all possible funding to support it. Worse, he designed every road in such a way that transit cannot be added either on the highway median or parallel to the road, as many planners advocated at the time, even passing up the opportunity to cheaply buy the land adjacent to highways for future transit. Carroll points out that city planner Dodd McHugh, working on a master plan for New York airports in the 1940s, urged Moses to provide space along the Van Wyck Expressway to JFK. In the 1950s, Moses ignored studies demonstrating economic value by providing mass transit along the LIE. When the Triborough Bridge and Tunnel Authority, under Moses' firm control, piled up surplus after surplus, Governor Rockefeller and Mayor Lindsay tried to spend some of that surplus on mass transit. Instead, Moses refused to let that happen and just planned another road. And as Carroll points out, the Moses image of being above politics was a myth, too. He fed the political machine with lucrative contracts, fees, and all kinds of favors to assure support of his projects. If anyone deigned to oppose or seriously question one of his projects, those contracts instantly dried up. And he so mesmerized the New York press that it turned a blind eye to his ruthless manipulations and the scandals and inequities his policies fostered. He conducted government in secret and by fiat and showed nothing but contempt for critics. One thing said of him that is true, he did not amass personal wealth, but he sure amassed personal power greater than anyone before him or since. As Jane Jacobs said of Moses, he perfected the art of negating the power of votes with the power of money. Outside of New York, transit was included in transportation planning. In 1951, San Francisco leaders, alarmed at what was happening in LA, initiated the BART process. Cleveland built a rail line on an unused right-of-way in the 1950s. Toronto invested their surplus from its streetcars and buses in the building of a new subway. A Fortune magazine survey in the 1950s showed automobile commuters interested in access to commuting by rail. The 1958 book, The Exploding Metropolis, a collection of writing mostly from the editors of Fortune magazine, and actually Jane Jacobs' first piece, included several essays urging less highway, more transit investment. All that I've noted is even before 1960. I won't even begin to dissect the myth that nothing gets done without Moses. Actually, I will. Nor will I include what Jane Jacobs first said about the erosion of cities by the car in her classic Death and Life of Great American Cities. I recommend, if you haven't read it, you better all go read it yourself. Nor does time allow to dispel the myths that Jacobs was against big infrastructure projects, four low-rise buildings, and four community control that would prevent neighborhood change. These are issues I cover in my book, but I have to say it's time we define infrastructure back to what it's supposed to be, which is more than just highways. It is ridiculous to think that we couldn't build roads, construct public housing, or create parks without Moses. Europe built whole cities after the war without destroying the urbanism that had been bombed away. And European cities have the streetcar systems we now envy, all rebuilt after the war while Moses built highways. Alternatives to Moses' plans were always available that did not erase neighborhoods, undermine social capital, and wipe out long-standing economic investment. Once he was gone, the alternative options had a chance. For good reasons, the rebound of the city occurred after Moses' departure in the early 1970s, and really only began in the 1970s when we hit our lowest point. Although in many unfortunate ways, much of his larger legacy lives on. If there is one overarching Jacobsian lesson, it is how complex cities are. Her observations of the village and all aspects of urban life only appear simple and are not an argument for similar scale and design neighborhoods everywhere. The idea that Jane might advocate a six-story building to be built adjacent to my 32-story apartment house or elsewhere in my neighborhood of 30 and 40-story buildings is ludicrous. Instead, her observations are a fractal for understanding thousands of streets and districts. A fractal is simply something that may look and perform the same at all scales of magnitude. Her observations of urban life in the village must be understood as a fractal to help observe and understand the components of thousands of streets and neighborhoods everywhere that have the potential to function in similarly vibrant ways, but have their own local character, own context, and unique qualities. Through Jane's local lessons, the greatest public has come to understand what are the components of a vibrant neighborhood or a whole city. The same public has come to understand their right and value to be a meaningful part of the process that leads to change. This is vintage Jane. Public process, on the other hand, was an anathema to Moses. Whenever these days a big project gets defeated or prolonged, the cry is heard, you can't get anything big done in New York anymore. This lament is coupled with the declaration that we need a Robert Moses to get things done. Well, first I would argue that many big things do get done. Second, they get done without Moses. And third, that some big projects get defeated for good reason. But when I hear that lament, that you can't get it done in New York anymore, I wonder what city they are talking about. Every corner of the city has been transformed by new construction in the last 15 years, and some pretty great projects at that. Only the current economic crisis caused the cranes that were everywhere visible to go into storage. But sometimes big proposals actually do get defeated. But does that mean all of them do? Evidence indicates otherwise. Is not the rebuilding of during the last 20 years of the city's mass transit big, in fact, huge and more complex and beneficial than any similar building project? The West Side Highway is getting rebuilt without Westway. And what about the ongoing construction of the $6 billion third water tunnel, billed as the biggest public works project in America? That's real infrastructure. One of the largest water filtration plants in the world is under construction in the Bronx in a 10-story deep hole blasted out of bedrock. Both Yankee and Shea stadiums have been replaced at the same time, a rail link to JFK. No small accomplishment, given the dissension that preceded its approval. A connection to the Long Island Railroad to the east side of Grand Central is also under construction. And that's not to even mention the restorative big projects like the restoration of Grand Central Terminal, the restoration of Central Park, Prospect, the Battery, Riverside Parks, and even now, the new waterfront parks on the Brooklyn waterfront. The Hudson River Park, which would never have emerged in its current vibrant fashion if Westway had been built, is the largest new park since Central Park. That park's restoration was a very big vision, accomplished in manageable increments until the large-scale whole was revived by its small-scale components. The park is not big in a build-new way, but big in a restorative way. None of these projects are about conventional real estate. Instead, they are about critical infrastructure, either of the kind that makes the city function or that adds to the quality of residential and economic life that makes it a desirable place to live. These are the kinds of big, very big, projects that Jane supported. Amazing that New York is addressing all of these critical infrastructure needs and more, and without a Robert Moses to get things done. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I'm going to take this moment to bring things up right up to today, and then we can look back to history. But we're at a moment for our cities, a very important moment in terms of infrastructure. There was a little bit of an opportunity, I think we both agree, in terms of the stimulus funding that was available, a bit like the funding that Robert Moses had available. And reauthorization of federal transportation spending is coming up. Probably won't be addressed until after the November elections. But with that in mind, I'm wondering what you both think are the prospects for a true transformation of the federal funding system in terms of an emphasis on highways versus transit. And wouldn't it be worthwhile to have someone or a group of people who could truly navigate the bureaucracy of federal transportation spending in the way that Moses did, but for transit and for perhaps inner city rail? So let me first ask Owen that question. What are your prospects for reauthorization to truly support cities with urban infrastructure of that
kind? I'm glad you guys can hear me now. I'm glad you asked that question because it gives me a chance to again draw focus attention on the importance of federal transportation policy. For most of the 20th century, we had a federal transportation policy that funded construction of highways nationwide without funding construction of transit. Transit died all over the country because there was no governmental support. We've always expected transit to be self-supporting. People talk about building a new transit line. They talk about what fare needs to be charged in order for it to break even or how much subsidy will it need. But we never talk about highways in that same way. The pendulum has started to shift on that. It started very gradually in the 1960s with the creation of the Urban Mass Transit Authority in Washington under the Johnson administration. You started to get funding for the Washington Metro, for the Atlanta MARTA, for the BART in San Francisco, isolated spots where there has been government funding for transit. But it's not isolated spots where there's been government funding for highways. There's, by definition, a highway is supported by government. And by exception, transit is supported by government. Even after the pendulum has started to swing back, it is still in favor of highways, in favor of decentralization, in favor of making it easy to build outside of cities and harder to build in cities. And by that I mean multimodal transportation infrastructure. When I talk about building, there's been no funding for any mode other than transportation to speak of. The amount of transit funding has been a paltry percent of the funding for rubber tire transportation. And it is starting to swing back. So it seems to me that every reauthorization in federal transportation policy that we've seen for the last few administrations has been inching its way towards something that's more balanced, and it's still imbalanced. So I think that it will be reauthorized. It will continue to shift more towards a mode-neutral funding bias. But we're way past the point where that's acceptable. We subsidized decentralization and automotive transportation for 100 years. And we need to, as you pointed out earlier, Anthony, cities are greener than the leafy suburbs. And I point out that contradiction there. And if we really want, as a nation, want to change the way we consume energy, the best way to do that is to have more people living in cities, have higher density but smart density in metropolitan areas, have more mass transit and less use of the automobile. And incrementally shifting that reauthorization is not going to get us where we need to be.
Roberta, are you hopeful about the supporting of our great cities with truly urban infrastructure. We have our first urban president for a long time. What are your prospects for?
Actually, I am hopeful, but I'm hopeful because there's so much local pressure from all different places on the federal government to do this, and I would not want to see a transit czar in charge of the funding of and building of transit, because I think transit is a by its very nature has to respond to the local, meaning the whole, not just a neighborhood, be a whole city, be a whole region. I think it's a very particular thing. I think actually roads should be that as well. But I think we have a long way to go. It's been, I remember writing an article in the 80s about this bunch of ragtag group in Washington trying to push for transit, and they were started out of the Rails to Trails group, and it was, they were nowhere. They were just being laughed out of Congress by the highway lobby. But nibble by nibble, a classic strategy of Jane Jacobs, they have inched their way into many areas where we see the revival of transit segments in cities all over the country. The first one I saw was in San Diego in the mid-70s. And then, of course, we saw Portland, Oregon. Neil Goldschmidt was the first to trade in highway money for transit. And we have seen these things, but I think it's accelerated in recent years because it's been so successful wherever it happens. More people want it, so there's more local pressure for it. However, look at the nomenclature. It's just a very interesting thing that people still talk about, and journalists write, about investing in highways, but subsidizing transit. Now, it seems to me we could do it the other way around. We could invest in transit because we've been subsidizing highways since the 1950s. And yes, transit somewhat died because of the post-war lack of funding for the local systems that really needed investment. But for many people know that there was a concerted effort proven in a lawsuit, convicted lawsuit, in which the whole consortium of General Motors, General Tire, and Steel, and everybody methodically went around the country and bought up and put out of business the streetcars. So it didn't die a natural death any more than a lot of other things didn't die a natural death, from whether you want to talk about industry in cities or people living in cities. There were all these either federal policies which did shape the shifts and some very concerted effort that turned these things around. So I am hopeful, but only because it's happening incrementally, city by city. The area that I think really requires some top-down vision, not vision, but support, is even a complicated vision on a local level, and that's the high-speed rail. I was just in a meeting the other day of someone telling me that even the planning of a high-speed railway from New York to, I guess, north of Albany, the whole line, Amtrak is insisting it be on its own dedicated rail line, which makes sense. You realize what's in the way of a whole dedicated rail line? When we start trying to build, and apparently in California, this is already a very important issue, not unlike some of the early highway battles, when you start putting a whole new infrastructure through a developed countryside or cityscape, This is not going to be easy. It's going to be a lot of local resistance. And the difference is that I suspect in most cases, unlike under Moses, in most cases, the compromise will be roots that cause the least damage. For anybody who read The Power Broker or heard, there are several roots in this city in which Moses' roads could have done a lot less damage, gone through a lot less community density if he had taken an alternative route. So that's what I'm watching for in terms of the rebuilding of transit around the country, is the different kind of sensitivity than when we build highways and how it evolves from the grassroots in terms of pressure on the federal government.
I just want to add a couple of things. One is, Roberta, you're absolutely right about that we've been subsidizing highways. But I do want to suggest we've been subsidizing highways since the 1890s. And the legislation in the 1950s that built an interstate was a culmination of a process that had been going on for a long time. And that's when I talk about the pendulum being way out in the wrong direction here and not being modally neutral between the two modes. And not being spatially neutral between strong center cities and development of periphery. We've been doing this for far longer than many people realize, subsidizing the automobile, subsidizing decentralization.
But I think...
Let me just finish here. The question with transit, it's interesting because I'm certainly not, didn't come here planning to be a defender of Robert Moses, who I think did any number of things wrong, and I'm on record in numerous places saying that we ought to have a very different approach to the way we do transportation infrastructure, and he did it. I think we must look at federal policy. I don't think this is something that we can solve only at the local level, because our degrees of freedom at the local level are constrained by federal policy that gives local government so few options. One reason why there are so few places that trading in highway money for transit money is because the bureaucratic process you had to go through to do that basically meant you were kind of saying goodbye to it unless you were willing to do a huge battle. If you wanted to spend it on highways, it was easy. If you wanted to trade it in for transit, it was much more complicated. And that's always been the case. The big transit story is that by the time the famous conspiracy took place between GM, Firestone, Conoco, bus companies, etc. By the time they formed a company called National City Lines and went and bought something like 52 different transit systems and shut them down, all of those transit systems had negative net worths and were losing money. So transit was dead before GM conspired to buy it and shut it down. So I think both of those things are important to really realize. Yes, there was a conspiracy. It was litigated, they were found guilty of it, and the court couldn't actually assign any dollar amount to the damages because all these transit systems were losing money because they were regulated differently than automobile transportation. They were only allowed to charge a nickel fare in many cases, sometimes slightly more, and that wasn't enough to cover their costs. So we had really messed up transit before the conspiracy came along. So my point is that these sets of problems that we're talking about are very real and a long time coming and are in many cases located in American cultural approaches and in policy that comes out of Washington. And we can fight them at the New York level and try to do better things as Janet Sadek Khan was doing in the Department of Transportation now in New York City. But we really won't make significant headway on this until we change federal policy.
Well, I think that you're right, transit was in pretty sorry shape, but we chose not to rebuild it. Europe chose to invest in it. We chose to either we have to distinguish between before World War II and after World War II. When we built parkways for leisure car drivers versus throughways for cars going, commuting and moving to the suburbs. We can't put it all, we can't go from the 19th century to the 21st century and not make distinctions of what happened in between when things were transformed. I mean, people talk about early suburbs. Well, the early suburbs were transit suburbs. They were along streetcar and rail lines. The post-war suburbs were along highways. It's a very interesting point of observation, and Jane Jacobs was all about observation, about what is, not about what is theory. If when you drive around and you visit different places, the way you can tell a suburb that was built after World War, developed after World War II, is the absence of sidewalks and the proliferation of driveways. And look at the difference in the house design. And the car was in the rear of the house and the lawn was in the front, to the point today that so many houses being built don't even have a front door. They just have a garage door. I mean, what have we, where have we come? So the distinction before and after World War II, because after World War II, we made an economic decision. Federal policy was decision was the way to get the economy back to domestic economy from a war economy was the automobile. And I'm not saying that that didn't have some legitimacy, but in order, and Alfred Sloan said this, in order to, if you're going to sell cars, you need roads to put them on. So it was a whole nexus of things that occurred after World War II that fed into the Robert Moses coming into to his strength right around that time and taking advantage of those interface. So the car was popular, as the show shows upstairs, but it was popular as a luxury item, as a leisure item. It was not something that we had to depend on. And I have to say, in many places where I've given lectures around the country, I get two very amusing responses. Oh, that's such a New York point of view. And I say, well, you know, it's very funny. And everybody west of the Mississippi thinks that there's nothing east of the Mississippi worth paying attention to. And everyone east of the Mississippi thinks that there's nothing of interest west of the Mississippi, and you're all wrong. Because it's all related, and I'm not against the car. I have two of them, and you can have three of them. The idea is not to be dependent on any one of them. And I don't think we have a very serious task ahead, because we have developed a countryside in which it's going to be near impossible to connect some of our built post-war communities, connect to transit. And it's going to take, in Death and Life, 1961, Jacobs has, I'm trying to find it before, because it's worth quoting, in which back then she said that transportation solutions of the future have to be combined many different modes of transportation and connections, and the way it used to, actually, with streetcars and in-town streetcars connected to urban, inter-urban, and then connected to heavy rail. The point being, in order to get people to a rail line, you're going to need shuttle buses, you're going to need mini cabs, you're going to need all sorts of forms of transportation. And I would say that Jacobs would also say, because we had talked about this, that you should let the market take its course. Let local people start their own little minivan system, which God knows you get to the Hamptons in minivans, but somehow the city doesn't want to let the dollar cars, pick up people along routes in Queens that aren't well served by mass transit. We have to think in a very different kind of web when it comes to solving our transportation problems, and not just subway, bus, rail, light, and heavy. It's going to be complicated.
Well, perhaps what's most hopeful is that we have people like the two of you to promote this dialogue. And please join me in thanking the board members. Thank you.